61 million Americans, that's 26% of our population, live with some kind of disability. These are our neighbors, our friends, our coworkers, and our family members. While the Americans with Disabilities Act has improved the lives of many since it became law nearly three decades ago, today's guest tells us the history and the ongoing challenges for those with disabilities can be stark. He's Peter Blank, this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to A Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, scholars, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States. To help us this week, we're joined by Peter Blank, University professor at Syracuse University, a title held by only eight other individuals in the history of that great school. He's also the director of the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse and one of the world's great experts on disability law and rights. Peter, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, you know, it's very sincere. The history of disability and disability rights and laws in the United States really gets started with the Civil War, is that right?
Yes. It was obviously a time of great transition in the country, North, South. And unfortunately, as is often the case in wars, disability rights often advance as a result. So after the Civil War, there are almost a million soldiers, mostly men, who were injured in battle. And in order to compensate this huge segment of the population, for the first time in the history of the United States and the world for the most part, they set up this huge bureaucratic system embodied in the Pension Bureau, which at some points in the late 1800s encompassed half of the federal budget, if you can imagine that. And wow. It was to compensate soldiers with all sorts of impairments you can imagine and disabilities for particular injuries. What was interesting to me was with that sort of bureaucracy came discrimination, exploitation, bribery, and other sorts of systems related to that.
In what respect?
Well, for example, in some of the books that I've given you and I've written about, there was terrific discrimination on the basis of ethnicity, for example. Irish veterans, all in all, were much less likely to get higher pensions. Of course, there was terrific discrimination on the basis of race. There was also terrific discrimination, interestingly, on the basis of the type of disability you had, whether it was deemed worthy of this money, of this national sacrifice money. For example, people who came back with what we would call today PTSD mm-hmm. and severe mental health disabilities were often excluded from the pension scheme. And unfortunately, in my latest studies, we look at the number of suicides associated with veterans with those sorts of disabilities who were not compensated.
Wow. So people who were not veterans, not involved in the military during that period, and we're talking about post-Civil War, where were people with disabilities at that point living in society, you know, in general society? I know there was a range of places where right. folk lived, but just give us sort of an overview of where people would have been.
Well, very briefly, of course, after the war, one of the first institutions to be set up for veterans were old soldiers' homes, which were the first kind of institutions the government sponsored. From that, and from the experience of the pension system, we quickly begin to see schools for the blind, schools for the deaf, and eventually schools for people who were called at the time imbeciles or feeble-minded, individuals who had mental disabilities, who society felt really didn't deserve to be a part of society at that time. Now remember, at that time, we were coming off society Darwin's Evolution of the Species and heading into the eugenics movement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So after World War I, even later, this culminated in a model, a medical model of disability, which permeated beyond veterans, as you say, out of sight, out of mind. And if you work hard enough, you can overcome your disability, and a charity and kind of pity model, which culminated in a very famous Supreme Court decision you're probably familiar with in 1920 called Buck versus Bell, where an otherwise famous and well-known Supreme Court Justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who had been a Civil War veteran, said in a case of sterilizing a young woman named Carrie Buck, who supposedly had mental disabilities, that three generations of imbeciles were enough.
Yeah, and there was a landmark book written about Carrie Buck.
Exactly.
I actually have a copy of it at home. So these institutions, they grew and multiplied. I mean, they were really all across the country. This wasn't in one state or one region. Is that true?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, the medical model, which dominated early discourse on disability, was basically a cure, pity, or rehabilitation model. And the way to do that was to segregate persons with disabilities from society. Unfortunately, as we know, over time, they became really deficient, really poor keepers of these individuals with disabilities.
Was the initial impetus, though, to segregate, was the theory that they were helping the people who had disabilities, or were they just getting people out of society?
I think it was both. It was well-intentioned in the sense that there was a sense of rehabilitation, particularly after World War I. The whole vocational rehabilitation model mm-hmm. began, trying to retool people for work. But there was clearly a sense of, in this eugenic period, pre-World War II and Hitler, post-Buck versus Bell, that society needs to be purified from many of these people. And the way to do that is to prevent them from multiplying and segregate them in institutions on the outskirts of society.
Were there voices of dissent, though, that sort of rebelling against this? What was at the time popular might be an overstatement, but an accepted scientific recommendation?
Well, the scientific recommendation at the time, based on my interviews with parents and others way back of kids with disabilities, is they would give birth to a child with an obvious disability, and the physician, the family doctor, would quietly say, put the child immediately in an institution.
Yeah.
So it was a time when there was no conception of disability rights, of no conception as disability as an element of the human experience as we think of it today. And once the civil rights movement of African Americans began, later by women, the disability community began to understand and grab onto the notion that why should you be discriminated just on the basis of disability? And the first cases, which of course in Rhode Island are very groundbreaking, you have that here in Rhode Island, were parents and advocates for these individuals, particularly with what was called then mental retardation, mm-hmm. today intellectual and developmental disability. Why are these individuals living in such filth, in such poor conditions? Which leads me to Burton Blatt.
And speaking of Burton Blatt, this is his landmark book. This was published in 1966. And he and a photographer went through a number of institutions in Rhode Island and elsewhere, and clandestinely
right.
took photographs of people and the conditions in which they lived. And I think we'll show our viewers later some of what is inside this book, but it chronicled horrendous abuse. People sitting in large groups, in some cases undressed, in many cases, most cases completely idle. There was no rehabilitation going on. There was nothing going on.
It was warehousing.
It was warehousing. And this also happened, by the way, to people with mental illness at that time. But this was a landmark book in 1966. So you are the head of the Burton Blatt Institute.
Right.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about this amazing person, Burton Blatt.
Well, he did what you said with the secret camera on his friend's belt. And I must say, that the lore is he snuck in, but in reality, there were good people who kind of let him in and wanted this story to be told, like the, you've described to me in Rhode Island and elsewhere. But there's no question that this book lit the fires of reform before Geraldo Rivera, before the Kennedys and the others who made great strides in this area. Burton Blatt became a beloved dean at Syracuse University School of Education, and he died very young, suddenly, after working very hard for deinstitutionalization. His family decided that they wanted to honor his memory, and they graciously endowed this new institute called the Burton Blatt Institute, which I have the honor of heading.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and what the institute does? I mean, it's clearly one of the world's leading such institutes.
Well, we have grown phenomenally with offices in New York City and Washington and Atlanta and Kentucky and Syracuse, of course, working all over the world. And essentially, we follow Burton Blatt's main principle, which is written about in that book, that each person has value. And we look cross-disability, we look over the life course, and we focus on ways in which we can help through policy and research support the inclusion of people with disabilities in all civic, social, economic activities. So most people with disabilities are poor and live in poverty. Most people with disabilities even today lack employment. We have large-scale programs, for example, on financial literacy, on economic security, on helping people be more involved, self-determined in making their own decisions about their lives to the maximum extent possible. So while we don't provide direct services, we have free resources on national resource centers in our institute, which provide information, outreach, and materials about the very personal stories of people with disabilities. Now, after Burton Blatt, if I may.
Sure. Please.
The fires of reform were lit. Deinstitutionalization was underway, closing of these large institutions. And in the late 1980s, people with disabilities, for the first time, came together, advocates, to try to understand if disability rights could be thought of in a similar way as African-American rights, as sexual orientation rights, as rights for women. And thanks to the leadership of many senators and really bipartisan efforts, the Americans with Disabilities Act was born in 1990, which was the first major comprehensive law in the world, really, that looked at employment, public services, telecommunications, living in communities, relevant to what we're talking about here, a very famous case called LC versus Olmstead out of Georgia, which basically said, the ADA says there shall be an integration mandate, and people don't need to live in these institutions when it really doesn't do them any good.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Peter Blank, university professor at Syracuse University and chairman of the Burton Blatt Institute at Syracuse. You can follow the institute on Twitter at BBI Syracuse. How big a population are we talking about in the United States?
Well, I have it's interesting in that regard, and I'll answer this question. One of my closest friends, a member of the Burton Blatt Institute, uses a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And he says when he goes to a restaurant, they don't just lose his meal if they can't get in. They lose the five family members' meals that want to come with him for that meal. So people with disabilities in the United States are roughly about between 60 to 75 million people. Wow. With severe disabilities. That doesn't include, of course, other sorts of attendant impairments that we all may experience. But it also includes, because the law provides that if you discriminate on the basis of your association with a person with a disability, then you're covered as well. The mother whose boss won't let her have some flex time so she can take her child to some treatment at a given point during the day.
That's somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 3,
yes.
Right? That's a surprising number.
It's a surprising number, and every story is amazing and different. The first story and case I was involved with after the ADA was passed, which is also to prevent stigma and discrimination, took me to Madison, Wisconsin. In Madison, Wisconsin, there was a Chuck E. Cheese pizza house. This is all public record. And they had hired a guy for the first time out of a sheltered workshop, one of these segregated workshops, named Don Perkle. He was nonverbal and had what you'd call mental retardation, today intellectual disabilities. He worked at Chuck E. Cheese, and everybody loved him. For whatever reason, Chuck E. Cheese is kind of like the Disney of restaurants. Mm-hmm. There's a big mouse, jumping castles. Basically, no place you want to be unless you have to be with little children on
right.
a Saturday or for birthday parties. So Don was doing great. One day, the big boss from Texas came up, not necessarily a bad actor, maybe uninformed, and said, pulled the local manager aside and said, "Who is that guy? Fire him. I don't like the way he looks." To their credit, this is a story of humanity, everybody in that store said, if you fire Don, we're all quitting in protest. Well, sometimes people, you know, stupid people sometimes keep lawyers in business. So he fired Don, and the case went to court, one of the first cases under the Americans with Disabilities Act. There was a trial. Long story short, after a 4 or 5 day trial, the jury awarded $80,000 or so in back pay to Don Perkle. I had spoken about the nature of discrimination and institutionalization and Burton Blatt's Christmas in Purgatory. And everybody was congratulating themselves, kind of like a 12 Angry Men movie. And all of a sudden, the jury foreperson raised his hand, was a guy, and said to the judge, "Judge, may I ask you a question?" And the judge said, "Of course." And the foreperson said, "We, the jury, would like to award Don Perkle another $13 million in punitive damages so that this never happens again in our community."
Wow.
And
that's amazing.
And lawyers, yes, it still is the biggest award
wow.
today. But lawyers being lawyers, the opposing side filed a motion which said, essentially, we hired a psychiatrist, and there's no way this psychiatrist says Don could enjoy the fruits of that $13 million. And we wrote back basically saying he would enjoy every penny of that $13 million. And the award was upheld, which is still, I believe, the largest award of its kind today.
And you were an expert witness.
I was an expert witness.
That was your involvement.
Talking about what we just talked about, trying to explain to the jury the history of this discrimination and why we should not push Don back.
Legally we're doing better.
Legally we're doing better.
How are we doing though societally?
You know, it's a very complicated question because today we have, of course, terrific issues of homelessness, mm-hmm. terrific issues of health care coverage, terrific issues of incarceration. I just did a recent case with the Southern Poverty Law Center, where we looked at the Alabama prisons, and almost half of the inmates in those prisons have some form of mental disability. The prisons have become essentially the institutions of old. And moreover, in Alabama, for example, what might you think would be the population of African American males in Alabama? It's 12%. What do you think is the population of African American males in the prison system in
Way
Alabama?
More than that.
A lot more than that.
60%.
Yeah. Wow.
Pushing.
Wow.
So we have a society today where disability rights are valued. We have pushback, saying it's another example of affirmative action. Why should Casey Martin, the golfer, be allowed to drive in a golf cart during a PGA tournament and not walk like everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Supreme Court said, because the essential aspects of golf is not driving or walking, according to the court, it's putting the ball in the hole and getting from one hole to another. So there's both advancement and pushback. And Burton Blatt Institute tries to be on the leading edge of that dialogue, the leading edge of why should it be that when a kid graduates high school, a kid with a cognitive disability graduates high school, the first thing the college counselors say to the parents is, at 18, you better arrange for guardianship. Why shouldn't it be, you better start thinking about, or they should have started thinking earlier, about how you can, to the maximum extent possible, allow this kid to make some decisions about finance or whatever. I say that because about 99% of all guardianships today are plenary. In other words, people have no voice, even though they may be able to, in control over their lives. So I can tell you another story, if you like, about that.
Absolutely.
Oh, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was contacted by this local lawyer about a little trial in Hampton Roads, Virginia, in a courtroom which was smaller than this studio, with a very senior judge whose courtroom was his fiefdom, and he decided what the law was going to be appropriately. The plaintiff, and again, I was an expert witness in that case, was a young woman named Jenny Hatch. Jenny is a woman with Down syndrome. Maybe her IQ, for whatever that means, is 56. Her adaptive behavior skills are amazing. She worked in politics. She ran. She was employed. She had her own smartphone. She did what she wanted in her life. Unfortunately, at some point, and this is not a good parent, you know, bad parent story, her parents decided, she had had an accident, that they wanted to be her guardians, and they wanted to tell her where she should work, where she should live, to get rid of her cell phone, and to have 2 hours a day to see who they tell her she can see. You know, it's a complicated issue. A young woman coming of age with a cognitive disability, there are issues of sexuality, there are issues of safety, mm-hmm. not totally disregarding the parents, but Jenny wanted none of it. So we went to court in this little courtroom in Hampton Roads, Virginia, and after a trial and telling this story again, as well as Don Perkel, the judge, for the first time in American history, scratched his head and issued an order saying, you know, let's give her a chance. Why jump right into guardianship? Let's try this thing called supported decision-making, which is just a new paradigm which allows people with supports of trusted friends or family to make decisions for themselves. Why shouldn't Jenny decide where she wants to work? So this little court case in Hampton Roads was then picked up by the Washington Post, was then picked up by People magazine, was then picked up by the United States government, you ask about Burton Blatt, mm-hmm. and a call went out for a new national resource center funded millions of dollars to understand supported decision making, how parents can use it, how friends and family members can use it. Lo and behold, they had cited our case in the first paragraph of the call, and our colleagues and us were fortunate to receive this huge grant to set up a national resource center, which is everything is free, it's all online, accessible, resources, state-by-state analysis, stories of success, all for parents and people with disabilities.
What's the website for that?
It's called the National Resource Center for Supported Decision Making. If you Google that, you probably will get it. I think it's supporteddecisionmaking.com.
We'll put it up on the screen when we edit.
But as a result of that, so now we're scientists also at the Burton Blatt Institute. The United States government said to us, with millions of dollars, run some randomized controlled trials, do some real research, and see if there's policy behind this supported decision making. So maybe we start changing the guardianship laws. That's a story of a very personal encounter, how it leads to systems and policy reform at a national and now international level.
It's a great story, a great outcome. I mean, it illustrates the power of story. Well, literally, this young woman's story.
And these stories are renewed for me almost on a weekly basis. I've written whole articles and books on these stories, and that's why I'm so pleased to be invited to be on your show.
Before we started taping, we were talking a little bit about the UN Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which I think you said 170-something countries
yes.
in the world have acceded to, but the United States has not. Why not?
Okay, well, I'll give some background first to try to spin that into a more positive.
We've got about a minute and a half.
Yeah. So there are about 1 billion people in the world with disabilities. And at the global level, the United Nations organized countries, now 177, to have a convention for the rights of people with disabilities. The first treaty of the 20th century was focused on what they call disability human rights, which is a little different than civil rights, which are more legally oriented. But in a nutshell, the United States decided it, President Obama signed it, but the Senate did not ratify it for an array of reasons, some of which have nothing to do with disability, but have to do with signing of treaties in general. Personally, I think it's a missed opportunity because we can all learn a lot together. Nonetheless, the CRPD is moving forward and more countries are being involved. It guarantees human rights of employment, accessibility to information, government services, capacity before the law, and a whole host of other areas which we've talked
about. For all people on the planet.
For all people on the planet, particularly those countries that sign on.
How did you get into this?
Well, that's also an interesting story, but I'll give you the brief version. depends who you talk to, my wife or others. I got my PhD first in psychology, and then I went into law, and having personal and professional exposure to family members and others with disabilities, I was very fortunate that my first job was as a law professor in Iowa at a time when Senator Tom Harkin was just beginning to put the touches on the Americans with Disabilities Act and had done some very early research on people with disabilities. And then it just took off, and with anything, it becomes kind of your life commitment even before you know it. The most important thing for me, which I would end with if we were out of time, is that the very personal nature of disability, it is about stories. It is about a narrative that when combined makes a compelling argument that all people truly have value. And this is different from where we started at the birth of the pension system.
We are so honored to have you on this program.
We really are. Peter Blank, thank you so much for being with
us.
It's a pleasure to have you here. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.